This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, March 25th, 2021. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On today's show, we take a look at the housing market in Northwest Arkansas. Just ahead, Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek brings us the first of a two-part report that looks at some of the challenges of purchasing a home in the region. And a number of bills impacting transgender youth in the state have been working their way through the Arkansas legislature this session. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on a piece of legislation that would require transgender students to be addressed by the name and gender on their birth certificate. Coming up on Here and Now, when Walter Kim became the first person of color to head up the National Association of Evangelicals, he wanted to build bridges, not fight a culture war. You can listen to a conversation with Kim next time on Here and Now. Tune in at 1 o'clock, right after today's edition of Ozarks at Large. Arkansas reported 13 more deaths from COVID-19 yesterday. The Department of Health also said there were 231 new cases of people testing positive for the virus. Active cases declined by 135 people to 2,128. Circle of Life is announcing a $3 million gift from the Willard and Pat Walker Charitable Foundation in memory of the Walkers. According to a press release, the $3 million gift will provide $1 million towards completing the capital campaign and $2 million towards the Charity Care Endowment campaign. The capital campaign raised more than $15 million towards a building maintenance endowment, patient wing expansion at the Erling Howard Hospice Home in Springdale, and the new construction of the Bentonville Hospice Home. To date, the Circle of Life Foundation has raised $2.4 million, almost 50% of their $5 million charity care endowment goal. Arvest Bank is sponsoring the inaugural Fort Smith International Film Festival with a $10,000 charitable gift to the River Valley Film Society, the nonprofit spearheading the event. According to a press release, Arvest's sponsorship supports the festival and additional year-round programs that are designed to enrich the artistic and professional lives of the River Valley's young professionals. Student outreach is underway in conjunction with the Peak Innovation Center and the Fort Smith Public School District by coordinating with teachers to get the students involved from the classroom. The inaugural festival is scheduled for August 13th and 14th. While the COVID-19 pandemic has slowed down a lot of economic sectors, the residential real estate market has not been one of them, especially in Northwest Arkansas. Earlier this month, Arvest Bank released its Skyline Report for residential and multifamily real estate in Benton and Washington counties for the second half of 2020. It found the historically low interest rates contributed to a rise in home sales, and the historically low inventory drove up home prices. In part one of her report, Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek tells us more about how the current state of the housing market in the region is impacting home buyers who've grown up in the area most of their lives and those making the move from other parts of the country.
My wife and I have been living in big cities our whole lives.
Corey Petrick is one of the tens of thousands of people who have moved to Northwest Arkansas in the last 5 years.
I was born and raised in Philadelphia and then New York City and then lived for almost 20 years in Los Angeles.
Petrick says back in 2016, he and his wife were planning to start a family and they didn't want to raise their future children in LA. So they started looking at other parts of the country to find another place to call home where they could both work.
When one of us finds something that's right, that's where we'll go. And then I found a listing on like a job board for an interesting job at an independent school building a film program. And I told my wife, I said, hey, there's this school and it has this really interesting job position. And she asked where it was. And I said, Arkansas. And she was like, no, don't even look at it.
But he did. And eventually, Petrick ended up applying for the job. He says he and his wife were surprised by how much they liked Bentonville when they visited so Petrick could interview for the position.
We then flew here. Even flying in, I've just really assumed that Arkansas was like dusty, like North Texas. And so when we were flying in, we both were like, wow, it's so green and there's trees out there and there's water. And there's someone like near us and they're like, yeah, you didn't know that? And we're like, no, we really didn't know anything about the area.
But Petrick says the area ended up checking all the boxes his growing family was looking for.
It's got a lot of nature. It's good cost of living. We really liked the job. We liked all the people we met here. Some of our friends in LA connect us with people that lived here that they said we should meet. And so we're like, okay, there's interesting people here. It kind of checked all these boxes and it also had some of that urban feel, even though it was a lot smaller than we really were looking for.
Once they made the move to Bentonville, Petrick says he and his wife decided to buy a house because it's something they had waited to do in LA.
I got a 2-bedroom house. It was super cheap. And it was so cheap, I couldn't justify buying. And then again, like years went by and then I regretted it because the neighborhood I lived in, like the house, for example, that I moved into, if I would have bought it at the time, it would have been around $100,000. And at one point, maybe 10 years in, I asked my landlord if he would sell the house, and it's a 500 square foot house. And he was like, sure, I'll sell it to you for about $700,000.
Petrick says many of the same things that made LA and Brooklyn interesting are happening in Bentonville.
That's kind of what we saw here. It's like there's the museums, there's good food, good coffee, good beer, biking. People are like into the outdoors. It has a lot going on that will attract people, but they didn't know about it yet.
That, combined with record low interest rates and comparatively low home prices, have created a problem of supply and demand. Mark Ryan is the executive vice president of Arvest Bank. He says there's not enough homes for sale for all the people who want to buy one, which drives up prices as certain buyers attempt to outbid each other.
Average home price in both Benton and Washington counties are at record highs from what we have seen since we first started doing the Skyline report. In 2004, so 16 years at a record high. Benton County, the average price of a home is now a little over $293,000 is the average price.
That's a 10% price increase from the second half of 2019 to the second half of 2020.
And looking back 5 years ago, that's over 40% higher than what it was 5 years ago. So again, we're seeing a fairly dynamic trend going on. Washington County saw the same thing. 11.8% higher in 2020 than 2019, and about 43% increase in 5 years.
The average price of a home in Washington County is now about $270,000. Ryan says there were also a record 5,800 homes sold in the region in the second half of 2020, but sales are starting to slow down because there aren't enough homes to sell.
And when they are on the market, they are selling is very quickly, faster than we've seen in recent history.
Realtor Brandy Mooneyhan says the majority of her listings are under contract in 24 hours from the time they go live.
In Benton and Washington County right now, we have 531 active listings. That's it. When I first started, I would say there was a minimum 3 times that, maybe even 4 times that.
When she lists a home for sale, Mooneyhan says she does her research to find out how much surrounding homes have been selling for, so the listing can go live at a reasonable price.
I think where the prices are increasing are because we have so many people that are competitively bidding against each other, they are actually driving the home price up. You know, you get 4, 5, 6 people bidding against each other on one particular home, and obviously it comes down to price. So sometimes we've seen a number of 20 plus bids on one property, and inevitably somebody's going to pay more because they really want the home.
When Mooneyhan became a licensed realtor in 2017, she says many of her clients were able to buy homes using rural development and Federal Housing Administration loans. But in the current real estate market, those types of buyers are having a hard time competing against conventional buyers who are able to put down 20% or more on a home.
What it has done to the buyers, one of the things that I fear is, or have feared, and it's a reality, we are coming up against, well, we have people that are first-time home buyers that maybe don't have that 20% nest egg, you know, to go buy a new home that would normally use these programs. They're pretty much being ruled out because they can't compete. They can't come in and compete with somebody that can just put down $40,000 cash on a $200,000 home.
But even some conventional buyers are having a hard time finding a home that's within their budget.
At this point, this is almost not quite a year later. We've been looking for almost a year now. And I don't think we're going to find anything.
That's Georgia Lance. Right now, she and her partner live in a fourplex in South Fayetteville. She says they've lived there for 7 years. But when management of the property switched hands recently, their rent went up by $100. She's preparing for it to go up another $100 when her lease is up for renewal in September.
So my daughter in California, who has been very successful in her life, said, look for a place to buy. I'll make the down payment. You make the payments. So we started looking for a place to buy. Well, what a joke this is in our price range. There is nothing in our price range. Anything that's listed that appraises in our price range, we are immediately outbid. This has happened numerous times now.
Lance is 75 years old, and while she's owned real estate before in neighboring Madison County, this is her first time trying to buy a home in Fayetteville.
And part of the reason we want to stay in Fayetteville is because we've lived here for 30 plus years. Our friends are here, my doctors are here, my bank is here, everything is here.
They've increased their budget from $150,000 to $165,000, but that hasn't been enough. And Lance adds, any house they purchase will likely have to be modified after a car wreck in the mid-90s left her with mobility issues.
It has been very frustrating, and it's frankly, I mean, we're pretty well discouraged. We've gone ahead and put our application in over at Nantucket Apartments on Morningside Drive in Fayetteville. But they're waiting, and for a two-bedroom apartment at market rate, we're not asking for housing assistance, we're paying market rate. The waiting list is 18 months to 2 years.
Nantucket Apartments is one of the few senior living communities in Fayetteville. As she runs out of options in the city, Lance says she is able to drive, so she's considering living in one of the neighboring towns.
I see the Fayetteville that I've known and loved for 50 years going away. I see it becoming a city for wealthy out-of-towners who are moving to one of the five best cities in America.
Patricia Rodriguez says she too feels like she won't be able to get out of living in a rented apartment.
Right now, I live in a two-bedroom apartment with my son, who's an adult, and my partner. And my partner and I have been working from home since last spring. And I was like, I need a third bedroom. I need a house. I need a yard. I can't do this anymore.
So she started looking for her first house.
And then I was horrified by the housing market last summer. I was just horrified and disheartened and disappointed and ended up just staying where I am.
Rodriguez says it's frustrating to have a full-time salaried position and a part-time job and still not be able to afford to buy a house in her hometown.
So there were three houses that they stopped accepting offers before I was even able to put an offer in. And I did put in three offers. I did submit three offers. And the three that I put in, I had offered $10,000 over asking and that I would be covering closing costs. And none of them were accepted.
While she'd like to stay in Fayetteville, Rodriguez says finding anything under $180,000 in all of Northwest Arkansas has felt impossible.
I was qualified with a co-signer who is not a first-time home buyer. And I did have enough. I was approved enough to buy a home, but I didn't want to be just paying only a mortgage forever. And I was quickly priced out of the market in Northwest Arkansas.
Some first-time home buyers in the area are still getting lucky. At least that's how Kelsey Ferguson feels after the last 6 months of searching for a home that fit her needs and budget.
I'm a native of this area. I've been growing up here my whole life. I remember when it wasn't cool at all. So I'm 28, about to turn 29, and I've finally become financially stable enough and, I guess, mentally prepared adult-wise to jump in to that life, right? Like I'm no longer interested in hopping from place to place and living in as many places as possible.
Ferguson quickly found out she'd have to adjust her expectations of where she'd be able to afford to live, since both downtown Fayetteville and downtown Bentonville were no longer options that fit within her budget. She says she looked at 20 houses, seriously considered 5 of them, and put in offers on 2.
Each time I would go through the process, we would find out what the seller needed. What was that secret sauce, right? Like, what was it going to take? And 9 times out of 10, it was cash, you know, no repairs, no matter the appraisal. It just kind of like, do you want the house or no? Can you afford to buy this home outright or no?
Ferguson describes the last 6 months as discouraging, until this past St. Patrick's Day when her girlfriend sent her a listing that was for sale by owner.
We went to go see it, and from the moment that we pulled up in the driveway, I knew this was the house. Like, I knew this is the one I wanted. We met the owners. We spent probably 30 minutes with them, let them give us the tour, got the whole scoop on their lives. Turns out they were also a gay couple looking to move elsewhere out into the country to start a homesteading life.
So they crossed their fingers and put in a conventional offer.
And it stuck. Like, not to say it was St. Patrick's Day necessarily, but we did get lucky. And I have to say, it doesn't feel quite real yet, because it's not real till the keys are in my hand. But it has been just like an elating moment for me to even have the opportunity to own a home in Northwest Arkansas.
Which realtor Brandy Mooneyhan says is not an easy feat in the current housing market, because there are simply not enough homes in Northwest Arkansas for everyone who wants one.
In my mind, we've kind of reached a plateau. We're here. We're literally, it's just trading off. If I've got a seller A, we have something over here, hopefully, that we can buy. There's no plethora of things to choose from and work through anymore. So I feel like in Northwest Arkansas, our market has kind of hit the peak. It might get a little bit worse.
And new construction, she adds, isn't keeping up with demand either.
People are literally beating on doors like, hey, we're ready to put an offer on a lot, and we're not even in a position to sell a lot to build on yet. It's crazy, but that's where we're at. And I think one of the ways that they can level it out is if interest rates start going up some. I pray they don't shoot back up like they used to be before, but obviously if they creep up a little bit, that'll slow some of it down and maybe help us levelize pricing and levelize our market and probably get some things churning and ebbing and flowing again.
But Mark Ryan with Arvest Bank says he expects that might take a while.
Even if rates go up a little bit, they are still very low. So we would have to see, I would say, at least 2 percentage points increase in mortgage rates. So that will take, at this point, we think it'll take a couple of years to get there.
Any changes in the housing market will also depend on developers and builders producing enough supply to catch up with demand.
The challenge there is that the cost of raw land is much higher today than it was back in the run-up to the last recession. And so that has kept development at a slower pace, which has kept the number of houses coming online at a slower pace. And so that's kind of why we're seeing a kind of a longer runway from the supply side to get caught up to the demand side.
A 2019 study conducted by the Northwest Arkansas Council and funded by the Walton Family Foundation projects more than 80,000 families will move to the region's 4 largest cities in the next 20 years. To accommodate that growth, Northwest Arkansas will need to build an additional 2,900 new homes each year. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
That same 2019 study recommends about half of the housing units built each year have to come at a price point that's attainable for a workforce household, which is defined as a family of four earning less than $78,000 a year. One of the ways regional leaders hope to make that happen is by implementing strategies that will be coming from the newly formed Workforce Housing Center. That's the topic of the second part of this report, which can be heard on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Little Guys Movers, a community-oriented company rooted in creating better lives for customers and employees alike, providing jobs and serving customers for over 28 years. More than just a moving company, littleguys.com for information.
A bill has been filed in the state legislature requiring public school teachers and staff to address transgender students only by name and sex cited on their birth certificates. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
House Bill 1749, filed by Representative Mary Bentley, Republican Perryville, bars publicly funded elementary and high school principals, teachers, and staff from acknowledging transgender students' identities.
I feel like that this bill is meant to be give some people the ability to purposefully be cruel to kids.
Transgender civil rights activist Jewel Hayes is a board member of Northwest Arkansas Center for Equality.
Like in Arkansas, in the South, we know some people are a little bit different and we treat them with respect.
We queried Representative Bentley, who sponsored and co-sponsored a half dozen anti-LGBTQ bills, including the SAFE Act, which bars gender-affirming medical care for minors and trans girls from public school sport. Bentley did not respond to a request for an interview. Jewel Hayes says legislators like Bentley this session are showing clear bias against gender-diverse Arkansas youth.
They are concerned about the, like, people searching for freedom. It's being blatantly disrespectful of one's right to be the person that they want to be and be addressed in the way that they want to be.
Kathy Campbell is a licensed professional counselor with a private practice in Fayetteville.
And one of the specialties of my practice is working with the LGBTQ community.
Campbell says if the measure is signed into law by the governor, it will cause harm.
You know, when students are trying to explore their identities, it's stressful to begin with. And having a bill like this won't stop students from doing this. They will still work to figure out who they are and claim their identity, their gender identity, and transition if that's what seems to be right for them. So the bill isn't going to stop that from happening, but it will create mental health problems, possibly where none exist, when students are not accepted for who they are, or it can exacerbate existing mental health problems, leading to more stress, more anxiety, more discomfort in so many different ways.
Campbell says her goal as a therapist is to help clients become the best version of themselves that they choose to be.
And I think that's the goal of the public school system, too, is to help students be the best version of themselves that they can be. And a law like this would interfere with that goal for students who are exploring their gender identity.
She says if passed, this law could cause psychological trauma for transgender students.
You know, who we are, our identity, is really almost a sacred piece of ourselves. And to not have that acknowledged creates intense anxiety and fear. It can lead to outcomes like social withdrawal, poor school performance, depression, suicide attempts. Just impaired relationships and a very impaired life for these students.
And to identify a student according to their recorded original birth certificate?
You know, when you call somebody by a gender other than how they identify, it's called misgendering. And when somebody is misgendered in public, it can put them in danger from bullying or harassment from other people who hear the misgendering. And realize that somebody who perhaps present as male has a female identity on their birth certificate, they can be in danger if that's revealed in public. And so I just see, and school students have told me that they're harassed if their teachers misgender them. And so these are some of the really negative outcomes that I see for a bill like this.
According to the Human Rights Campaign, Arkansas House Bill 1749 is one of 82 transgender measures filed by state legislatures across the U.S. in 2021, a record number. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Advocacy groups are voicing their opposition to multiple bills in the Arkansas legislature targeting transgender people. Representatives from the Human Rights Campaign and the American Civil Liberties Union hosted a virtual news conference yesterday about the bills, including one banning transgender girls from playing girls' sports in schools. Human Rights Campaign State Legislative Director Catherine Oakley says they're part of a national trend.
This has been an unprecedented year for attacks against the transgender community. In particular, this year, the focus has been attacking transgender youth, their access to medical care, and their access to sports. Particularly in a year where we've been isolated from each other, and children in particular have had a really difficult time and not being able to be at school, not being able to be with their friends.
Governor Hutchinson has said he's unsure whether to sign the transgender sports ban into law, though he said he would like to see it accompanied by hate crimes legislation. ACLU of Arkansas Executive Director Holly Dixon said any bills strengthening the penalties for hate crimes would not make up for legislation discriminating against LGBTQ people.
Arkansas does not have civil rights protections for LGBTQ people to protect employment, housing, or public against employment, housing, or public accommodations discrimination. So to say, we actually care about your rights if you've been assaulted or killed, and we'll put someone in prison a little bit longer, while at the same time passing state-sanctioned discrimination, is the wrong message.
The bill in question, Senate Bill 354, passed the House on Monday and is awaiting the governor's signature. Another bill, which bans transgender youth from obtaining transition-related medical care, is awaiting a vote in the state Senate.
Cuba is trying to create its own coronavirus vaccine, even as the island is facing shortages of food and other medicine.
We are trying to develop sophisticated vaccines, but people don't have painkillers. That's the paradox.
I'm Audie Cornish. Cash-strapped Cuba tries to go its own way. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can listen to All Things Considered this afternoon from 3 until 6 here on KUAF.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Calling all entrepreneurs, you can now apply for Walmart's annual Open Call event. It's a chance to pitch new and innovative products that are made, grown, or assembled in the U.S. The virtual event brings entrepreneurs face-to-face with Walmart merchants for a chance to get their product on the retailer's shelves. Last year's event saw 850 companies earn a chance at a virtual meeting. This year's event, the 8th for the retailer, is now open for submissions, accepting through April 30th. Only companies that produce, grow, or assemble products made in the U.S. are eligible. The event will be held June 30th. You can find out more details in our story at nwabusinessjournal.com. After the break, we will hear from Dr. Chad Rogers for his reflections on the past year of the COVID-19 pandemic. You are listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
It has been one full year since the onset of the COVID-19 crisis in Arkansas. To look back on the past 12 months, Roby Brock caught up with Dr. Chad Rogers for his perspective. Rogers is a pediatrician and the chief medical officer for the Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care.
It's been a bit long year. We had daylight savings time the other day. I said some people feel like they lost an hour. I feel like I lost a year. But it's been a tough year. It's sort of interesting. I was kind of reflecting on this the other day and when I was kind of thinking about what we're going to talk about today. You know, about 20 years ago, I was sitting with a colleague who was working for an insurance company who was working on disaster preparedness. And one of the things he brought up was, you know, that there would be this pandemic and, you know, talked about the Spanish flu. And I even having recently finished medical school, I didn't know a lot about the Spanish flu and what had happened at that time. And when he kind of talked to me about it, I didn't really believe that was going to happen. I mean, certainly, you know, I had been exposed to the flu. I've had the stomach virus and I survived. Didn't really ever think there would be this sort of novel virus that would come through and cause so much trouble. I think, you know, one thing, it has had a tremendous impact on our healthcare system, but I didn't really anticipate the impact that it was going to have on our economic or, you know, just the psychological part, just the overall wellness of people. I think it's hard to believe that we've gone through a whole year of being quarantined and dealing with a pandemic. And, you know, the implications have just been much broader than I ever thought.
It's been tough. I think about the, you know, over 5,400 people whose lives have been lost to, and that is just an incredibly large amount of people who have died because of one particular disease in such a short period of time. But we do have vaccines now. You're at a vaccine clinic in Searcy, as a matter of fact. Tell me a little bit about what the experience is like at that, and then I want to ask you some broader questions about vaccines.
Sure. So, you know, it's exciting if you think about everything that's happened within the last year. The fact that we have a vaccine within 1 year of the first case in Arkansas is just kind of phenomenal. It's a great part of science and technology. So, yeah, I'm at Searcy today. They're doing a vaccine clinic here for AFMC. It's sort of supporting with, along with the Fellowship Bible Church and Unity Health. Huge turnout. Of course, the governor expanded the group yesterday to the 1C category. And so they just have a lot of people. And I think people who want the vaccine are getting the vaccine, which is very rewarding to see. Actually, the level of excitement is a little hard to explain because people are so thankful to be getting the vaccine. Our first vaccine experience is that, you know, grandparents were, you know, hoping to get to see their grandchildren. Then you have people who just want to, you know, protect others by getting vaccinated. They don't want to get sick. So I think we're getting more data about it. But it's really exciting. So, you know, I think there's still a lot of misconceptions about vaccination out there, that this vaccine was developed kind of quickly and that it didn't go through all the usual channels. But, you know, these vaccines are going through, even though they're getting emergency use authorization, there's still, you know, the number one goal is safety. The second goal is, you know, that they're effective in preventing, number one, getting sick, getting hospitalized, ending up on a ventilator. I think that that data is well known, and that the vaccines were not just kind of quickly developed, but were based on previous vaccine technology. So I think we can feel pretty good that, yeah, I have actually had the vaccine myself. I had the Pfizer vaccine and have been fine. So certainly encourage others to get their vaccine.
So we did see from the governor when he made that 1C announcement that our vaccine adoption rate in the state is still relatively low. I think only about 10% of the state is fully vaccinated at this point in time. What do you, with him opening up 1C, with the fact that manufacturing and production of vaccines are going to increase because of the Biden administration's push on this, what do you expect to happen over the next month or two?
Yeah, again, I think the first two groups that the governor and the health department kind of opened the groups up to, people who wanted the vaccine hopefully got it or had access. And I think, you know, we definitely kind of work towards that. But, you know, the more people who get vaccinated, the more you get to this herd immunity. And so by expanding to a larger group, because there are a lot of people out there who want to get vaccinated. And even though they may not be in a high-risk group, they may not be, you know, elderly or have other healthcare complications, by getting vaccinated, they create that herd immunity, the percent of the population that sort of needs to be reached in order to protect yourself and to protect others. So I think it's really good. It's a big group. And I think we're all kind of rapidly trying to respond to the demand for people who want to get vaccinated. You know, very safe, very effective, good thing to do for not only yourself, but for the community.
And that is Dr. Chad Rogers, who is the Chief Medical Officer for the Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care, talking about vaccines. All right, other headlines this week. Massachusetts nonprofit Entrepreneurship for All will launch a free year-long business accelerator program in Northwest Arkansas. A Walton Family Foundation grant is backing the program. It will start this summer in both English and Spanish. And the University of Arkansas says Justin Urso is the new director of the McMillan Innovation Studio in the Sam M. Walton College of Business. And America's Car Mart in Rogers has appointed bank executive Don Morris to its board of directors. Morris, most recently the chief digital banking and marketing officer for First Horizon Corp. of Memphis, will fill the board vacancy after the retirement this past August of former Walmart executive Jim Von Grimp. For those stories and more, visit nwabusinessjournal.com, where you can keep up with our reporting of business news each and every day. I'm Paul Gatling, and that is today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Colon cancer is the second leading cancer-related cause of death in the United States. In the latest installment of our series with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences about aging and health, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talks with Dr. Sheena Carley, an assistant clinical professor at UAMS and associate program director for the residency program for internal medicine at UAMS. She says colon cancer doesn't have to be the second leading cancer cause of death in the country,
but it's also the most preventable and the most treatable if caught early enough. We also know that there's a higher incidence and a higher mortality in our African-American population, and they have been underscreened up until now.
All right, let's talk about the screening. Is it fairly easy to get an appointment and then to go through the screening?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So there's lots of different ways of screening. So this is kind of a long answer. Traditionally, screening is done with a colonoscopy, and that's a little bit more time intensive. So you have to do the prep the night before, emptying your bowels completely so that the GI doctor or the proceduralist can get a great look at the colon and make sure that no polyps or other abnormalities are missed. The thing about the colonoscopy is it's, of course, invasive. You'll probably need to take time off from work or other obligations, and there's sedation involved with that. That can be off-putting for some people. So there are other screening methods that have become more widely accepted now. So there's a FIT test, which is the second most recommended by the American College of Gastroenterologists and the American Cancer Society, which is an at-home test that looks for blood in the stool. That one is great because you can do it at your own convenience in the privacy of your home. There's no dietary restrictions or changes to medications that have to be made ahead of time, and you do that annually. Then there are newer tests like the Cologuard. You may have seen commercials for that on TV. That's another one that you can do at home at your own convenience. And that one tests for stool DNA associated with cancer mutations as well as blood in the stool. And that one's done every 3 years rather than every year. Now, the most important thing to know about screening tests is if you choose not to do a colonoscopy and do one of the at-home tests, if it comes back positive, you must get a colonoscopy to look at why it was positive and make sure that there are no precancerous or cancerous polyps in there.
The CDC suggests a big majority of new cases of colorectal cancer in people 50 and over. I think a lot of us have heard that's when you should start thinking about getting a colonoscopy, getting a screening test. Is that good advice as we get older to think more seriously about it?
Yes. And the literature is changing a little bit on this. So if you look at the guidelines set forth by the gastroenterology societies and the internists, they're still saying to start your screening at about 50 years old for average risk individuals, and then continuing screening at regular intervals through the age of 75. However, we are seeing more lately that colon cancer is popping up earlier. And so because of that, the American Cancer Society and a couple other guiding societies have recommended that we start screening around 45 years old. And so that's a conversation that you want to have with your primary care doctor on what's the right time for you based on your personal risk factors and family history.
And that could include, I know that if people who might suffer from Crohn's disease might want to consider earlier. And there's some other factors, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we consider higher risk for colon cancer if you have, like you said, inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, or ulcerative colitis. If you have a personal history of polyps, you might be at higher risk for colon cancer and you might need more frequent screening. If you have a first-degree relative with colon cancer, you would be considered higher risk and might need earlier screening as well.
What's a first degree familial?
A parent or sibling.
Okay, so very close, nuclear family.
Yes.
Are there things we can do in our life besides getting screened? Are there things we can do so when we do get screened, it's less likely we see polyps and have a chance for cancer?
Yeah, that's a really wonderful question. So there are things that we're seeing that are associated with the development of colorectal cancer and maybe why we're seeing it more in young people these days. So things that are associated with developing colon cancer over time are obesity and a sedentary lifestyle. Also, high intake of red meat and processed meat like hot dogs, sausages, things like that, as well as tobacco use and heavy alcohol use. Those are some of the big risk factors that are modifiable.
Dr. Sheena Carley is an assistant clinical professor at UAMS and associate program director for the residency program for internal medicine at UAMS. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums for our ongoing series in collaboration with UAMS about aging and health.
When you turn on KUAF, you could hear almost anything from breaking news to immersive stories from around the world and even the voices from your own community. You turn to KUAF for insights, information, and entertainment. And this spring, KUAF is turning to you. We're raising money at the end of March to help keep the public radio you hear every day on the air. Be a part of our spring on-air fundraiser, March 29th through April 2nd. Help make a difference to your public radio station, KUAF 91.3.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with sound perimeter. Frédéric Chopin wrote his Etude Opus 10, number 12, in C minor, Revolutionary, in 1831, as a patriotic statement after he heard of Russian troops taking over Warsaw, the Polish capital city where he grew up. Up until Chopin's times,
etudes were short pieces of music, typically for one instrument, designed as exercises to improve technique or demonstrate the performer's skills. Frédéric Chopin's etudes were different. Not only they forced the pianist to practice, but also became stand-alone pieces, worth to be performed in the concert hall and all the audiences. This etude is particularly difficult, especially for the constant rapid notes in the left hand. Here, there is an interpretation by Eugene Kissin. Each year, as enacted into law on August 17, 1988, Americans observe National Hispanic Heritage Month from September 15 to October 15. During this time, we celebrate the histories, cultures, and contributions of American citizens whose ancestors came from Spain, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central and South America. September 15 is significant because it is the anniversary of independence for Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Furthermore, Mexico and Chile celebrate their independence days on September 16 and September 18. Also, Columbus Day, or Indigenous Peoples Day, or Día de la Raza, October 12, falls within this 30-day period. Today, I want to share with you an act of musical revolution, the inclusion of Chopin's revolutionary etude in Sonido Bestial, a track from an album with the same name released by Latin musicians Bobby Cruz and Richie Ray in 1971. Sonido Bestial is notable for the bridging of both salsa and classical music as equals in a seamlessly and unexpected way. Let us listen. Sound Perimeter today with Sarah Willis, the first female brass player of the Berlin Philharmonic. Another revolution. Today, we will experience her collaboration with the Havana Lyceum Orchestra and music director José Antonio Méndez Padrón in the album Mozart and Mambo, performing an arrangement of the third movement of the third Mozart's horn concerto, K-447, renamed for the occasion Rondo a la Mambo. Happy revolutions to all, and happy month-long celebration of the year-round contributions of American citizens whose ancestors came from Spain, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central and South America. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
The nonprofit Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese is hosting an International Women's Day celebration from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday at Willie George Park, which is located near the intersection of Don Tyson Parkway and Hilton Road in Springdale. Celebrating women through health and education will begin with a dawn vigil to honor Marshallese in Arkansas who've been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. Michelle Pedro is the Coalition's Policy Director and Communications Specialist.
At 7 o'clock, we'll hold a candlelight vigil in remembrance of those that have passed away from COVID and they have left their families behind. It's just been a really, really tough year for our families here in Northwest Arkansas. And so we wanted to hold this in remembrance for them and just to let them know that we're still behind them and that we're still here for them.
According to the Arkansas Department of Health, since the pandemic was declared, more than 3,400 islanders have contracted COVID-19. Of those, nearly 60 Marshallese have died. After the vigil, a masked and socially distanced walkathon and Zumba workout are scheduled.
Our women are there at home, especially now during the pandemic. And so to get them out and just socialize a little bit, social distancing, of course, following the guidelines, and just to see each other again and to be with each other.
Springdale resident Neeson Locum will commemorate U.S. nuclear weapons testing on the Marshall Islands 70 years ago, which destroyed portions of her indigenous land and irradiated islanders living downwind. Food boxes will also be distributed to Marshallese women and families in need at the event. International Women's Day, which is celebrated annually on March 8th, is a global celebration of social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women. For more information about this organization, visit facebook.com/Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Goshen, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Susanna Sitek, Jacqueline Froelich, Kyle Kellums, and Leah Uribe. Thanks to Paul Gatling for producing this week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report, and to our content partner KUAR in Little Rock for sharing sound from the Human Rights Campaign's press conference. Thanks also to Timothy Dennis for mixing and mastering today's show. Our theme song is written and performed by Daryl Sean. On tomorrow's edition of the program, we'll learn more about the recently established Workforce Housing Center and talk to some of the band members of Modeling about their new music. And in our weekly conversation with Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, she'll offer a preview of three theater performances you can watch this weekend. Those stories and more tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you have a fantastic rest of your Thursday.